Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point, broadcasting from the stateroom high above downtown Boston. I've got a live audience and very special guests. NPR correspondents Adam Davidson and David Kestenbaum of Planet Money are with us. You've heard their radio dramas on This American Life and their reports on the global economic crisis on All Things Considered and Morning Edition. Maybe you download their podcasts every month and read the Planet Money blog. Whichever way you hear them, you know Planet Money is telling our economic story in a whole new way. In plain English, not jargon, in dramatic reenactments, and in candid conversations with ordinary Americans and financial insiders. How do they do it? We're asking this hour on Point, Adam Davidson and David Kestenbaum of Planet Money. We'll be taking questions from our audience this hour. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Adam Davidson and David Kestenbaum are with me here on the set. I'd like to take a moment to introduce them to you. Adam Davidson is international business and economics correspondent for National Public Radio and the co-creator of Planet Money. He co-produced the Peabody Award-winning episode of This American Life, The Giant Pool of Money. Adam Davidson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much.
And welcome to you, David Kestenbaum. Before David started covering the financial crisis for Planet Money, he covered science and energy issues for National Public Radio. Earlier this month on This American Life episode, The Watchmen, he examined what went wrong with the credit ratings agencies. David, great to have you here as well.
Thanks for having us.
You both have such interesting backgrounds. David, you have a PhD in physics from Harvard. Adam, before coming to NPR, you were a Middle East correspondent and general assignment reporter for Marketplace on Public Radio International. Adam, what was your intent with Planet Money and creating Planet Money? What were you hoping to accomplish?
When we did that show, The Giant Pool of Money, a little over a year ago, I thought this is never going to work. An hour of radio about mortgage finance and securitization. And Alex Bloomberg, who did the show with me, kept saying, no, we can make it not only, you know, good, but we can make it funny and compelling and with real characters and drama. And, you know, with Ira Glass and the team at This American Life, it really seemed to work. We really were able to take some of the more arcane aspects of our financial system and make it intelligible. This is before the crisis hit its acute phase, so it wasn't on everyone's mind in the way that it has been in the last 6 months, say. And after we did that, it just seemed obvious that there was this hunger, I mean, this ravenous hunger. And again, this is before September when the crisis really took off. There's this hunger for just clear, straightforward explanation that's like other things in your life. There's humor, there's sadness, there's human stories. Finance doesn't have to be this totally other world where, you know, it's just secret people talking some secret language that nobody understands. And so it was just sort of figuring out. And it wasn't like there was a moment where we decided. It just seemed obvious that NPR and This American Life and we should make that happen.
David, you're one of the great success stories, really, out of this economic downturn. Did you expect this? Did you expect the response that you've had from Planet Money?
I didn't actually know where we were going with it. I was busy reading textbooks over last summer with people walking by me at our local pool, thinking I was feeling like I looked like a real dork. it's been great. I mean, I have that hunger that everybody else out there has because I was new to this when we started, of really just wanting to understand this. And, you know, when I listened to Giant Pool of Money, you were like, I get it. You know, here are the actual people who do these things talking the way we try and, you know, it was the same thing we tried to do with science for years, you know, to put it in human terms.
Well, in the midst of a complicated and confusing financial crisis, you have been the model of clarity to many people, including, I might add, to politicians and policymakers in Washington, D.C. I want to play a clip, an exchange in March, between Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Senator Max Baucus, Democrat from Montana.
You know, I don't want to overstate this point, but I have to be listening to NPR. It's American Experience, American something, about a week or two ago. I'm trying to explain all this in simple terms. Started a little balance sheet. This guy has $10 and, you know, loan to So when I'm thinking, my way to Dollhouse and so on, they just got it more and more and more. I thought it was very well done.
Yeah, they did. I thought they did a very nice job. I agree with you.
Yeah, and if somehow you can just talk about this in just more basic, sort of simple terms and put it in terms that the average American household, you know, relates to, that might help quite a bit.
This American experience, the American something.
Right.
Yeah. So you've been at this a year. You start hearing these kinds of kudos from Washington.
Yeah, let's just stop for a second. I mean, you're watching C-SPAN, and a senator is telling the Treasury Secretary that he should be more like you. And this Treasury Secretary says, yeah, that guy is pretty cool. It's unbelievable. I can't tell you how
but
exciting that is.
How have you been able to unpack these very complicated issues and make them so simple and so easy to understand, David?
I spent years dealing with incredibly complicated, arcane areas of science, so it wasn't that different. The difficulty is always getting the people to talk to you. And I feel like in science there were all these props, like there'd always be some million-year-old beaver fossil or something that you could trot out on stage and people would say, oh yeah, that's interesting, you know. That doesn't really actually exist. Here your props are synthetic collateralized debt obligations, which are basically just air. And so it's a challenge, yeah.
I think the thing you need to do is spend a lot of time, like we suffer for you, is the thing. We have to read, we have to dig really deep into these financial products, into these financial instruments. I start every one of these processes, it bored out of my mind. The drama is not on the surface. You have to just dig. And I find with some of this stuff, it takes weeks, months of telling yourself the story, telling your friends the story, before you realize there's a narrative here. Our colleague Alex Bloomberg pointed out to me the other day that just now, 2 years into covering this crisis, that he realized, oh, when people say there's a liquidity crisis, when a bank says there's a liquidity crisis, that means I can't borrow money. When banks say there's a short-term funding crisis, that means I can't borrow money. When banks say the commercial paper market dried up, that means I can't borrow money. And he's like, oh, they're just like me. They can't borrow money. And it's realizing that behind the jargon, behind the stuff that is so off-putting, there's something that we know. There's someone who wants to make money, and to make money, they need to borrow money, and the way they borrow money isn't working because no one trusts them. But getting at that simple narrative, it just takes a lot of time it's almost like you have to go beyond the point where you're analyzing it, and you're just living in it, and then you're like, oh, I see the drama all around me.
Let me play for you in this now famous program, The Giant Pool of Money, which aired on This American Life last May. You spoke to a guy named Clarence Nathan. He worked 3 part-time jobs. He made roughly $45,000 a year. He hit rough times, took out a $540,000 loan. And the kind of loan that helped to cause this whole mess in the first place, which was called a no-income verification loan. I want to listen to Clarence and get your take on the other end.
I wouldn't have loaned me the money, and nobody that I know would have loaned me the money. I mean, I know guys who are criminals that wouldn't lend me that money, and they break your kneecap. So, I don't know why the bank did it. I'm serious. $540,000, a person with bad credit.
That initial story, Clarence's story, what do you make of it now that we're past the initial shock of the crisis? Is it still unbelievable to you, this kind of story, which you heard over and over again?
What was unbelievable to me about Clarence Nathan is he was the first guy we interviewed for that, and he laid out the whole issue perfectly clearly. And later in the show, he explains that what he says is, the bank didn't cheat me, and I didn't cheat the bank. We joined together to cheat ourselves.
A partnership.
It was a partnership. And I think for us that was a crucial insight. Yes, there were criminals. There were a lot of criminals. And yes, there were victims. There were a lot of victims. But at the core of this crisis, I think, was this mutual self-delusion that existed at the retail level, at the home buyer level, and existed all the way up to the chain. It's not to say everyone's equally guilty or equally free of blame, but it is to say that basically to understand the financial crisis, you have to understand, oh, a lot of people went a little bit nuts.
And here's the other side of the coin. You spoke to a guy on that program named Glenn Pizzolarusso in the Giant Pool of Money, as I mentioned. He was an area sales manager at WMC Mortgage in upstate New York. He was making $1 million a year just out of college. Here he talks about living the high life, spending tons of money, and hobnobbing with stars in New York City.
Christina Aguilera was doing a, you know, whatever, like if I'm Christina Aguilera, I'm going to get up and sing. So Christina Aguilera and all her people are there. Who else was there? Cuba Gooding and that kid from Filthy Rich Cattle Drive. What was that kid's name? Fabian Barabi, whatever. You know, we order probably 3 or 4 bottles of Cristal at $1,000 a bottle. They bring it out with, you know, they're walking through the crowd. They hold the bottles over their head. They put, there's firecrackers in them, the sparklers. You know, the little cocktail waitresses. So you order 4 bottles of those. They're walking through the crowd, you know, of people. Everybody's like, whoa, who's the cool guys? Well, we were the cool guys. You know what I mean? They gave me a black card. You know, this little card with my name on it. There's probably like 10 of them in existence. You know? And that meant that I just spent way too much money there.
There's an honesty in these interviews that I hear.
That is the tape that is so hard to get. I mean, that's the real story. That's out there. There are a lot of people with stories like that. I can't tell you how hard it is or how many people we interview till we find people who can tell it and are willing to tell it.
But a 25-year-old guy making over $100,000 a month, owning 5 houses in the New York metropolitan area. He now lives in his parents' basement. But we're very grateful to him for being so open and honest. I mean, it's easy to...
Tells a compelling story.
Yeah.
We're talking this hour with David Kestenbaum and Adam Davidson of Planet Money. After a break, we'll talk about Bernie Madoff and much more. I'm Jane Clayson, broadcasting from the State Room in downtown Boston. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point, broadcasting from the State Room high above Boston's Financial District. We're recording a live broadcast today. My guests are David Kestenbaum and Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team. We'll be taking questions from our audience later this hour. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. David and Adam have a unique approach, shall we say, to explaining the financial world. Here's a March 13th podcast where you focused on Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Along with Alex Bloomberg, you enacted a radio drama to explain how a Ponzi scheme works. David played Madoff. Alex invested $100 with you and received $10 every year. Here's a bit from that.
So this goes on for a few years, and every year Alex wants his $10 that I earned him. Here you go.
All right. Thank you.
And he just, you know, takes
the
that.
The years preceding.
The leaves preceding. And, yeah, you know, I also pay myself handsome, you know, pretty handsomely. Maybe, okay, I'll take $40 here for myself, build myself a nice house. And pretty soon I run into a problem. Here, Alex, another year. After 6 years, I've given Alex back $60. I've taken $40 for myself, and now I'm out of money. And another year passes.
Hey, Dave. It's a... 7 years into our relationship, into our financial relationship, and I'd like my $10 annual return.
Hey, Adam.
Oh, hey, David. Yeah, what's going on?
Hey, how would you like to invest some money with Kestenbaum Securities? You can talk to Alex. He'll tell you what a good job I've done.
Dude, this guy is great.
David Kestenbaum, first of all, how did it feel to be Madoff for a day?
I felt great.
We didn't take it all the way up to the arrest.
But we did have real money in the studio. That was very important to us.
Yeah. And seriously, Bernard Madoff will be sentenced on Monday. What are the long-term implications of this particular scandal?
Well, there are definitely long-term implications for the SEC. I mean, they've taken a lot of heat for missing this. I mean, it has really sort of come to define them recently. You know, what you're seeing is that in the times of financial crisis, people like Bernie Madoff, who've been able to keep it going for years and years, people decide they want to take their money out, and you find out, as someone said, you know, who is wearing clothes and who has been swimming naked, you know, when the water level drops. So what we found in doing this is that, like, these issues are confusing, but if you play them out, if you say, okay, I'm going to go get some monopoly money, like, let's act this thing out,
it's a lot easier to follow. And even from my own understanding, at the very beginning, we were struggling with, like, where did the money go when the bubble popped? And I just brought in a bunch of Monopoly money, and it made it a lot clearer. So the radio drama has been very useful to us.
You mentioned the SEC, the Boston man who worked for a decade to pursue and persuade the SEC, right, to go after Bernie Madoff. Mr. Markopoulos told Congress that the SEC is made up of lawyers who are basically financially illiterate. What do you make of that?
They are definitely fighting that image. I mean, if you listen to the end of that podcast, actually, Harvey Pitt, a former chair of the SEC, said, "This is not the SEC that I know." And I think it's hard to know whether there are some people in there who missed this or whether the whole organization is dysfunctional.
Can I say what I love about doing these radio dramas, and I hinted at this before, covering money and business is very different from covering the Middle East. Because in the Middle East, at some level, you don't know what's going on. You really don't. But with finance, at the end of the day, someone wants money, and they either got it or they lost it. And it's maybe their strategy was good, maybe it was stupid, whatever. And whether that's a person or a government or a business. And so when you try and just focus, wait, who's trying to make money? How are they trying to make money? Did they make money? Did they lose money? It makes it a little bit simpler to follow. It's a little easier because it's one dimension. It's not, or two dimensions, whatever. It's not 100. It's not string theory like the Middle East sometimes feels.
A couple of questions for you guys about Wall Street and U.S. banks. One of Planet Money's friends, the economist and MIT Simon Johnson, MIT Simon Johnson, believes that as we move forward, Wall Street has prevailed, and that the big banks and shadow financial systems have come through this with the American taxpayer bearing all the burden, bearing the downside here. And the bankers are getting the upside, big profits, big bonuses. Do you agree? And if so, how did they get away with it again?
I think, you know, we're journalists, and we try not to have strong opinions. We love Simon, and sometimes I wish I could just be like Simon and just say, I'm going to take a real swing for the fences and say this. What does seem surprising to me is when this crisis started, the acute crisis back in September and October, I was talking to Simon and lots of other economists who've been studying the banking system for decades and who said, at the core of our economy is a real problem. We have these institutions that are too big to fail, and there's an implicit guarantee that the government will rescue them if they're ever in trouble, which acts like a free insurance program that big financial institutions get that no one else gets in our economy. And we're ending it, it seems, with the major change being it's no longer an implicit guarantee, it's now an explicit guarantee, and that insurance program is even more certain. So while there probably will be stricter regulation and maybe there will be less shenanigans for a while, it seems that at least one of the core issues in this crisis is it seems likely, is not going to be resolved.
You say that the banks are too big to fail. If that's true, then why are they too big to exist? I mean, why can't they be broken up if they pose such a risk to the American economy, to the global economy? David Kestenbaum? Well,
I wanted to back up first and say a lot of what Simon's saying there is uncontroversial. I mean, everyone in Washington says this is terrible. You know, we want to let these places fail. We can't because they serve a special function in the economy. So, I mean, part of what he's saying there is not, it's not a lot of people would agree with, right? As far as too big to fail, the Obama administration proposal is that we are just going to regulate the heck out of them. We believe, I suppose, the argument is that there are economies of scale, and there, if we limit the size of companies, they would go abroad. Or, you know, the way to do this is to properly regulate these institutions individually, and that if they do fail, we need to find some way to be able to have them fail without bringing down the whole economy, other than just limiting their size.
We kind of exist in three worlds, I'd say. So we deal with Wall Street, and Wall Street's actually pretty straightforward. They want to make money. And there's not, as a general rule, abstract principles. They're not more free market or less free market. They don't care. They just want to make money. And if a free market helps, great. If it doesn't, get rid of it. Then there's academic economists who have a lot of really, really smart things to say, but aren't elected and don't have power, don't have to deal with those issues. And they come up with really beautiful, pristine models of how the economy should function. And then there's Washington, which to me feels a lot more like the Middle East. Like it's just a lot of people doing a lot of stuff, and I don't fully understand why they're doing what they're doing. And what comes out seems kind of ugly and really problematic and nobody's ideal solution. Even President Obama said the day he announced his plan, this is not a perfect plan. This isn't the plan I dreamed of. I think he said, I think you have some tape of that. He said, this is the plan we could get across, you know, get through Congress. And so it, I guess, when you deal with academic economists, you think, yeah, why isn't the world perfect? When you deal with Washington, it's kind of shocking that anything good comes out of it at all.
Let me get some questions in from our audience. Here's a question from Bob in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. He says, our son and daughter-in-law are gainfully employed high school teachers in Connecticut with savings, good credit, and jobs. They are buying a house but are finding that Bank of America is dragging their feet in approving their loan. What is going on?
We had a bubble of credit availability, and now we have a bubble of credit unavailability. And, you know, whenever there's over exuberance in one direction, there tends to be over pessimism in another direction. So, I mean, obviously we don't know the details, you know, are they deadbeats? Are they really responsible? We don't know. But to the extent that it was far too easy to get credit, it's going to be a bit harder. And that has real implications. It means that, you know, they're not going to buy a house. They're not going to, maybe, hopefully they will, but they're, you know, they're not going to fill it with consumer goods and durable goods. They're not going to build some equity in that house that they can borrow against and, you know, make other purchases or become an entrepreneur or whatever. And that probably will continue for some period of time. We don't know how long this dearth of credit availability will continue.
Here's a question from Catherine Mann. She's an economics professor at Brandeis University. She says, let's talk inflation. With more than $1 trillion into the economy, isn't inflation on the horizon and soon?
You know who I would call to ask that? Catherine Mann.
You can tell us if we get the right answer. I actually just took the U.S. economy for a doctor's office visit. I went to the International Monetary Fund to ask this question. I said, hypothetically, let's say we have a country. We won't give it a name. Let's say it has 13.8 trillion GDP. Let's say it's been lowering interest rates down to zero and pumping as much money as possible into the economy. What would you tell this hypothetical country? And he said, this is Carlo Cottarelli.
Yeah, do the Italian accent.
Carlo Cottarelli. And he said, don't worry about it. No. he said, in the long term, in the medium term, you know, we are telling every central bank around the world they have to have an exit strategy because it is a concern down the road. Right now, we are more worried, frankly, he didn't say this, but more worried about deflation. We're more worried, you know, there's not enough demand right now. The problem is not inflation in the near term, but people need to be thinking about how they're going to take all this liquidity out of the market.
Here's a question from a 12-year-old in our audience from Manchester, Massachusetts, Parker Malarkey. How are we ever going to generate the capital needed to pay back the Chinese?
So I think very good question from Parker. You know, obviously we keep hearing China has lent us all this money. Basically, they buy U.S. government debt in the form of treasury bonds for a variety of reasons. Basically, we're gonna roll that debt over through time. You know, we don't ever seem to fully – we don't pay it off. We just, you know, borrow other money to pay the money that we borrowed. Generally, what we're going to do is grow our way out of it. I mean, $1 trillion looks like a certain amount when you're a $13 trillion economy, and 20 years from now, if we're a $20 trillion economy, it'll look like less.
But to a 12-year-old, it's a lot.
Right.
and me.
The other issue is inflation. A typical way that governments get out of a huge debt burden is through inflation because debts are in nominal terms. It's $1 trillion, whether inflation is 2% or 22%. And so if inflation is much higher, that $1 trillion will mean a lot less money 10 years or 20 years down the road. That's a fear. The Chinese have expressed that as a real fear, and that would probably be pretty painful for us as well. But it is a choice many governments have made to get out of the pain of paying the debt back. I would say that My view is that it's probably overstated. It's not really like the Chinese hold us. It's a mutual assured financial destruction pact because they are so dependent on the U.S. Economy. They're not in a position to make too many demands, frankly. But if it does get much higher, I mean, something else Simon Johnson says is overall our economy was, say, we had 40 or 50% of GDP in debt. We're now closer to 70, 80%. We know from experience that once you get to 95, 100% of GDP, which we were after World War II, but when you get there, that's a really dangerous place. So we're halfway between pretty safe and pretty dangerous, and we don't quite know what that means.
Here's a question from our Facebook page, On Point Radio. This is from Nicole Boothman Shepherd. She says, if the Fed was instrumental in the collapse of the American banking industry, what is the rationale behind devolving more regulatory control to it?
She should run for Congress. That's going to get a lot of votes.
what do you think, David Kestenbaum?
You're hearing a lot of people on Capitol Hill uncomfortable with that. I think the counter-argument is that throughout this, the Fed has been taking a real leadership role in trying to come up with ways to unfreeze the credit markets, and they've also proven to be very useful there. So a lot of the frustration is with, their oversight, the part of their job which is overseeing the banks, and I don't know where that's going to end up.
Yeah, we had this talk, again, September, October, November was a very exciting time, believe it or not, an exciting time in the bank regulatory community. There is a view that we had this crazy hodgepodge system in America. No one ever came up with the system we had. Something happened in 1907. They came up with some rules in 1913. Then we had the Great Depression. They came up with a bunch of rules. Then the 50s, they added some rules. In the 60s and the 70s, every decade or so, there's a crisis. They add a new regulator. They change things a little bit. You end up with this crazy hodgepodge where there's some areas that are way overregulated and massive areas that are way underregulated. It's a nutty system. No one would wake up one morning and say, hey, let's make this crazy system. And so there's all this talk that was, hey, we're going to just blow it up. I mean, obviously it was a total failure. We're going to blow it up, get rid of it, and start from scratch. The British did something like that in the 80s where they just got rid of everything and had one regulator and started from scratch. And now it seems like, nah, we're not going to start from scratch. We're going to do what we've done every decade or two. We're going to add some more powers. We're going to shift the roles. We're going to get rid of one regulator and add another regulator or two. There is something sad about that. Maybe it's the right thing to do. I don't know. But there is something. It was sort of exciting to think we could really imagine a new system.
Let me squeak in one last question before the break. Doug in Newton, Massachusetts. Asks, how will consumer spending be different 2 to 5 years from now?
The big phrase you keep hearing now among economists or finance people is the new normal. I don't know if anyone's heard this phrase, but the new normal. It's will we go from a period where generally the economy grows at, say, 3% a year on average to 2% a year on average, which it might sound like not that much, 3 to 2, but it's massive over time. In any given year, it might not be that big. But over 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, that's a big, big difference. That's living a different life. That means our kids, instead of making twice as much as we do now in real terms, are making, only a little bit more than we're making now. I'm not doing the math very well in my head. But And there's a lot of implications to that new normal idea. Living in a country without the same level of growth expectation changes. Do you go to school or not? Do you invest in? Do you become an entrepreneur or not? How do you think about leisure and family time and work? It changes everything about our society. The problem is, people are really bad at predicting the future. So if they're saying that's the new normal, that people are going to be spending less money, consuming less, that the economy will grow more slowly, that makes me think, they're probably wrong. The consensus is generally wrong. But obviously, I have no idea.
David Kestenbaum, do you believe the U.S. economy is going to tank further? I mean, if so, what signs should we be looking for? We have some more dark months ahead?
We used to have a couple favorite indicators we would look at on the podcast. One was the TED spread, which was a measure of how freaked out the banks were to lend to other banks. And We had a party when the TED spread got below one or something. Yeah. And the banks who should know other banks are not freaked out right now. That made us very happy. There's another indicator we look at, which is it's sort of iffier but interesting also. It's called the fear index. And it's a measure. It's complicated how they get it, but it's basically a measure of how worried people are that the stock market is going to make huge jumps up or down. And that people are still very uncertain. They don't know what to make of it.
We're talking with David Kestenbaum and Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money. After this break, we'll talk about the way forward and how it might look on the other side of this financial mess. I'm Jane Clayson, broadcasting live before an audience in downtown Boston this hour. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We're broadcasting from the State Room in downtown Boston. We're recording live in front of an audience today. My guests are David Kestenbaum and Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team. The Planet Money team puts tough questions to movers and shakers of the financial world. And Adam, in February, you interviewed Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. Here's a little bit of that.
I don't have to tell you. There's an awful lot of people in Congress, an awful lot of people out there in the world who think, I'll just put it frankly, that you and others have turned America into a bunch of suckers, that, you know, we're not getting the best deal that we could. And that if you were running a hedge fund, you'd call that bank and say, forget $50, I'll give you $30 for the dollhouse. You're in trouble. I'm not, you know, I want to see a lot of upside potential.
Well, Adam, let me try it this way. What our obligation is, and the obligation of your government is to try to get this financial system fixed as quickly as possible so that credit is flowing again. And to do that, the government has to take risks that the private market cannot take at this time. And that is a necessary thing to do, because if we don't do that, then we're going to see much more damage to businesses and families across the country.
Adam, David, I'd like to hear from each of you on Secretary Geithner. What's your sense of him? Adam?
Well, I got to say, that was the most frustrating interview. I mean, it goes on like that for 22 minutes, where I feel like I'm asking pretty straightforward questions, and it's the same talking points again and again and again. And I know people who know Tim Geithner socially, and they say, you'd love him. He's funny. He's lively. He's an interesting guy. He has successfully hidden that aspect of his personality from the public view. I mean, I think he has a lousy story to tell, and so there's a reason he's not telling it that clearly. I mean, the story goes something like, we genuinely felt like we were facing the worst crisis in financial history, including the Great Depression. This was worse than that, potentially, in our view. And so we transferred a huge amount of money from taxpayers to really rich bankers. We completely shored up a bunch of irresponsible banks who don't deserve it. And we're not going to fundamentally restructure the system because we think that's too risky and we can't get it through Congress. That's a hard story to tell. If I had to tell that story, I think I would say things like, we are managing risk and allocating risk, utilizing a variety of...
What's your take, David?
I try and go watch Tim Geithner speak as much as possible just to kind of be in the room with him, and because I'm in Washington. And there, as Adam says, there just aren't that many cracks. Occasionally someone on the Hill will get to him. Someone a while ago said, do you know how radical this proposal is? Do you know how radical this proposal is? And the most got out of Tim Geithner was, he said, this is a very reasonable proposal. You know, he got a little animated, but he's been very, very reserved.
I want to give you a few other names, and I'd like you to give me a couple of sentences, your thoughts about these players in the financial crisis. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. Adam?
So everything I understand about this crisis, or the bulk of what I understand, is Ben Bernanke's incredibly important academic work in the early 80s, mid-80s, where he really taught us what the banking system means to the U.S. economy, or to any economy, and that without a healthy banking system, we don't have our way of life. And it helps me understand the thinking. It really, really does. There are things that confuse me, and I mean my instinct, based on everything I know about Ben Bernanke and everything everyone I know, even people who are politically very different from him, I've never heard a bad thing about him personally. I'm a man of incredible integrity. The implication of his work, though, in the 80s, that banking system is crucial to our economy, it very quickly becomes a handful of specific banks are crucial to our economy. You know, the top four banks make up something like 2/3 of our banking system. The top 10, I forget the numbers exactly, make up something like 90% of our banking system. There are big implications to the work he had, and I don't know that he's in a position to address those implications. But I'd love to see the forceful explanation of the implications of his work at some point.
David Kestenbaum, Congressman Barney Frank of the House Financial Services Committee.
Barney Frank, everyone we talk to out there, they feel like he is the guy they need to deal with and the guy they need to convince. Actually, when the bailout at some point was headed in a very different direction, they were actually going to buy up the toxic assets. And, you know, it was in Barney Frank's committee that a small clause got added in, which said, you know, if you want, you could do it a different way. And by buying preferred shares in these banks, and that clause actually ended up being used, and a lot of people say that was really the right thing. You know, people agree and disagree with him on issues, but I think they feel like he knows his stuff.
Let's cross the political aisle. John Boehner, House Minority Leader. Adam,
it is strange. I think it's come through. Can I just say this? Like, we at Planet Money tend to not like Congress very much because it just feels frustrating. It feels like there's this really rich, interesting debate going on in America, and then there's this other thing happening in Congress, which isn't the debate that's either happening at the high academic economist sort of big thinker level, and it's not happening really at the street level of sort of where we are. It's this weird power play where issues like, does the Agriculture Committee get to control derivatives, or does, you know, Barney Frank's committee get to control derivatives, and that's tied to the success of the Farm Bill. I mean, all these like political battles that have nothing to do with what's going on. And I feel like Boehner and much of the Republican leadership is, I don't want to say like criticize them and not criticize the Democrats. I want to criticize them both really strongly. But I feel like the Republican leadership, I just don't know what are they doing. Like, what is their view of what the system should be going forward? We understand what they don't like about some of the proposals from the Democrats, but I don't see a consistent view that really deals with the feeling in the street and the realities of this crisis. I find it very confusing.
Here's a question about Congress from one of our audience members. David Friedman in Boston asks, is it realistic to expect that members of Congress will truly understand the actual problems with our economy, let alone the proposed regulations? David?
Well, we spend a day, an intense day on Capitol Hill, and I go there more often than that, talking to lawmakers about this. And I have to say, a lot of times, you talk to members of Congress and you get talking point. What's been refreshing about this is that there are people out there who are genuinely wrestling with these issues the way that we are, and sometimes they're very candid about it, saying, I don't know what to do. I am taking one lawmaker told us he takes home a stack of papers and he has this choice. Do I like sleep? You know, or do I read this? And he's been reading it. You know, a lot of them are really trying to wrap their heads around. It's a very, very complicated issue.
But why do they have to rush? That's what I do, and I feel like I'm a journalist. I don't want to express such strong opinions, but I don't understand the rush. We talk to many, I don't know, we talk to 13, I think, people on the Financial Services Committee. It's a big committee, 70 people, something like that. But almost every one of those congressmen said, I don't understand. I don't really. Many of them don't know what the Fed does, let alone how they should change their role. And so it just strikes me, how do you decide what the Fed should do and how it should be different from what it did before if you don't even know what monetary policy is? It is confusing.
Here's a question about universal health care. In the news this week, health care, President Obama speaking about it. Here's a question from our audience. Will access to universal health care and its front-end cost help our financial stability in the future?
I think we're on a quiz show. I didn't prep for that one.
Yeah.
What do you think? How will health care either make or break us moving forward? Adam?
It is a huge long-term macroeconomic issue. It's a much bigger issue for Europe and Japan than it is for us because we have all these young immigrants replenishing our working age population. And you know, Europe and Japan, especially Japan, are in really, really bad shape. I mean, just the numbers don't add up. How do you function if you don't address that issue? Obviously, you need to address it in a way that's sustainable. Some government solutions could be very unsustainable. Others could be more sustainable. So I don't think universal healthcare isn't specific enough to know how that will help. But if we don't, in some way, address healthcare and the whole package of an aging population, that's one of the biggest threats to our long-term economic health.
Here's a question from Tom. He's in Newton, about the environment. How can we take advantage of the economic downturn to advance policies that encourage positive impacts on the environment? Debbie Kesterbaum?
Well, people are driving less. That's a help. I feel like we're in this special time now where everything is broken so badly that there is this opportunity for new ideas. And it comes with financial regulation. Also, President Obama is trying to push, trying to do something about climate change. And the House, I think, is voting this week. And they're considering a cap and trade proposal. They're big economic problems. They're just big technical problems also. I mean, people think about electric cars. You say, great, it's an electric car, runs on electricity. There's nothing coming out the tailpipe. That's fine, but the electricity is probably generated by a coal plant somewhere. I mean, these are just massive, massive structural problems. And these are, I think a lot of people are happy we're starting, but we're at a very small start right now.
Here's a question from our website. Carl Salzman asks, what role did the commercial and public media play in the financial crisis?
So I think, you can find heroes, you can find good people who really did a lot of predictions, and you can obviously find massive, massive blind spots. There's no question. I think for me, looking forward, what I would love to see, I think while there have been wonderful reporters and wonderful areas and newspapers and TV shows and radio shows, overall, I think we've divided economic coverage. There's sort of economic coverage for the pros that, whatever 99.5% of the country has no idea is happening, doesn't read, the business section is beautifully presented so you can throw it away and not have to mess up your enjoyable reading of the paper. And then you have these like personal finance publications which sort of promote probably maybe the wrong approach to money, that it's something you should actively be managing and trading. And then you have sort of general interest stuff that probably on average dumbs things down a little too much and doesn't. And so I think, I will say I think Planet Money is a step in the direction that I'd like to see where I don't know how you cover healthcare without really understanding economics. I don't know how you cover the war in the Middle East. I don't know how you cover, climate change. I don't know how you cover almost any key issue without economics being at the center of your coverage, or at least very central to it. And I don't think that's been a priority in journalism. It's been segregated, like bridge coverage or coverage of the game bridge. And I think that is the original sin, in my view. That's the thing that needs to be addressed.
What's the lesson in your mind, David?
There was coverage of the housing part of this. People were getting loans under these ridiculous conditions. I think what nobody saw, and there were people, journalists, okay, it's our job to dig into some of this stuff. There are people who had millions and millions of dollars at stake and also didn't see this. There can be a housing bubble, but you don't know if it's going to pop or if it'll deflate slowly. And then the idea that that would connect to bring down the banking system at the center of our economy, like, I think, we've talked to so many people over the last year, and it's hard to see anybody who saw, more than one piece of it.
I'm curious, when the economy improves, if it improves, do you fear that listeners to Planet Money will lose sort of the raison d'etre for what you do?
So first of all, it will improve. It will improve. We don't know when, but it will. It will improve. Most of our life will be spent in a growing economy. This will be a blip, maybe a big blip. I think there is. I covered Iraq, and I remember when everyone was going out and buying books and trying to learn what a Shia was and what a Sunni was, and what's going on, and you know, I say this thing. I like to say it's a joke, but it's not a joke. It's just an actual explanation. I say America went from fascination about the Middle East and Iraq to boredom without ever passing through knowledge. And that is my fear now, is that we've gone through a period. I mean, the stories I remember when it was hard to get a story on the radio about the Fed actually changing interest rates because it's so boring and who cares. And now the Fed not changing interest rates is front page news and everyone wants to know about it. And there is sort of a bubble of enthusiasm and interest in economics and finance, which I think naturally, as it does, will go away as the economy straightens out. I think, you know, Planet Money was not formed to cover this crisis, and I think we've got a decent shot at making a case to our listeners that there's a lot of drama and good storytelling that we can provide around the area of economics and finance in the long term. But I think it's going to be more of a sales job than it has been.
The thing that I love about economics is that it is the way that physics was for me, which is that it's all these invisible strings that control so many things out there in the world that it's a very powerful way of thinking about the world. And a lot of people have been listening to Planet Money over the past year and This American Life shows. I think they've really come along with us, and they are up to speed on a lot of this stuff. And I think a lot of them will stay with it. I mean, when we healthcare coverage, like a lot of these issues have economic sides to them. And I think people, through this very painful and dramatic period, have become acquainted with things that are a lot more complicated than they'll have to be acquainted with for these issues we're going to be coming down the road.
You tackle the most complicated issues and explain them in the most unintimidating way. Is there ever an issue, have you found to this point, that you can't explain?
Like hundreds. Yeah. Every day. Yeah.
We will have these discussions. We have these meetings, and we're like, "Yeah, that's really crazy." And then we try and map it out. And we're like, or sometimes you just try and write the first paragraph of the story, and you're like, "Oh, forget it. you just actually can't write it."
What's the on the record interview that you'd like to get most as it relates to all this?
What I want most is not a big name. It is someone who worked at one of the credit trading desks, preferably at Citibank, Citigroup, UBS, or Merrill Lynch, to just tell us, like, what was it like? What were you doing? What did you know about the products you were creating? What was were you confident in them? Were you not confident in them? Were you deliberately hiding risks from your own management, from your own self? And just to say it in an open, non-defensive, non-lawyered up way. That's my dream interview right now.
David Kestenbaum, 10 seconds.
Yeah, I'm on the same list. I mean, those are the people we look for all the time
and can't find.
Thank you for your tremendous work. And thank you for being here with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Adam Davidson and David Kestenbaum from Planet Money. Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.